Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. A Salt Lake City rabbi says a Utah man was killed in Israel. Governor Cox says Utah is not a sanctuary state, citing an outdated ICE memo shared with state leaders. Northern Utah's ozone problem is not getting any better. And a new survey shows what Utahns think about how the state should grow. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jordan Miller. Jordan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Hello. Reporter Peyton Harkins is with us.
Yes. Hey, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for joining us. Renewable energy reporter Tim Fitzpatrick joins us.
How are you, Tom?
Good, good. Thanks for joining us. And real estate reporter Tony Simmered. Tony, thanks.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Let's start with Jordan Miller. Of course, we're all hearing about the war now in Israel after Hamas attacks, the worst in decades, and unfortunate news that a Utah man was killed in Israel. Jordan Miller has the story. Jordan, thanks.
Yeah, this was just really tragic news this week. We had found out from his rabbi who posted a tribute to him, and I had reached out to chat with the rabbi about who Latan was. His name was Latan Abir. He was 24 years old. And then I also talked with one of his friends here in Utah.
So first of all, tell me how he died. Well, I guess first of all, what was he doing back in Israel?
Yeah, so I believe he had moved here in late 2022 after he finished his military service in Israel. And he had traveled back to Israel to this past summer for a variety of events. Like, there was a wedding for someone who was a part of the Utah Jewish community in late August. And then he attended this rave, which was sadly attacked over the weekend. And they were notified, people in Utah were notified around Saturday as he had attended the rave with, I believe, two other people who were from Utah. They were able to escape, but he was reported missing Saturday night. And unfortunately, Sunday, they were notified that he had passed away.
In this rave, of course, one of the first attacks, I believe, Hamas came over the border. Hundreds killed, I think, or a lot of people killed at that rave, unfortunately, including this Utah man, Latan Abir. Before we have you tell me about him, a little more about him, his friends are talking about him, what kind of man he was. What about the other two Utahns? Any wounds or anything? They were able to... They escape without death, obviously.
Yes, they were able to escape. I believe one of them was injured by shattered glass from gunfire, but both were able to escape, and they were able to contact people in Utah later Saturday and let them know what had happened and that Latan was missing.
So this man, Latan Abir, 24 years old. What are people saying about him?
Everyone had told me that he was really fun-loving and kind-hearted, that he had a really contagious smile, he loved music, he was a DJ, and that he was just really a kid enjoying the rave, and that he was very active in the Utah Jewish community and attended a lot of their, I think it was the Young Jewish Professionals events and things like that. That was the picture attached to the story was from... I think it was a Purim party that they had previously. But yeah, he was just, by all accounts, a very fun-loving, kind-hearted person with a very contagious smile. And they said his loss would be a loss to all of them.
He moved to Utah late last year, I understand.
Yes, late 2022. I think it was after he had wrapped up his military service in Israel.
Do we know what he was wanting to do in Utah?
I'm not quite sure. I think I had heard that he had friends here, and that's why he had moved here and became very active in the Jewish community. But he, by all accounts, had just a really great connection here with the Young Jewish Professionals in the Jewish community in Utah. and he was a very kind and fun person to be around.
I guess there are a collection of young Jewish professionals here, and I guess the rabbi here, talked about him as well. He attended the, I guess, the congregation there.
Yes. He attended a congregation here in Utah. I think it was the I'm not sure which congregation it was, but the his rabbi was Avery Mizapel, and he was who had originally posted about Watan and his death.
So you quoted in your story, the United Jewish Federation is writing about the impact on all communities, especially in Israel, right? Friends and family being called up to reserve duty from reserve duty, war in Israel.
Yes. There's been a couple of rallies this week to support Israel. I know there was one on Tuesday night and also one on Wednesday at the Capitol that I believe the governor attended for prayer and inspiration and also just support for the Israeli community.
The governor has ordered flags at half staff, right? I guess through today.
Through Friday evening.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Anything else you'd like to say about this, Jordan?
I don't think so. I just am really grateful to those who were willing to speak with me. I can't imagine what they're going through. I'm obviously it's a tragic event, so.
Yeah. Very, very, very sad, the war itself, and then this Utah connection. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you.
So let me turn to Peyton Harkins. You had a story out before we get to the other story about immigration, about rallies. Tell me about the rallies on Tuesday and Wednesday, I think.
Yeah, there was the Tuesday rally had a host of sort of, Utah leaders. Lieutenant Governor Deirdre Henderson was there. Senate President Stuart Adams was there. Salt Lake City Mayor Erin Mendenhall was there. And that Tuesday rally I know had, I think I'm going to say at least a couple hundred people there, in support of the Jewish community, flying Israeli flags and things like that. And then the governor was set to attend the one at the Capitol. I'm sure he did, but I didn't personally go and cover it, so I'm not, certain on that. And then I also, I reached out to people, in the, the Muslim community centers, the Muslim Civic League, I think specifically, and they haven't had any sort of rallies themselves. They, told me they were a little bit afraid to do that because they believed retaliation was real. And so actually yesterday, Salt Lake City PD put out a press release saying that they've increased patrols around these community centers, both Jewish and Muslim, just to try to give people sort of more sense of safety. They said it wasn't in response to any sort of actual threat, but it's kind of precautionary. But yeah, that's what I know.
These Muslim centers, officials, any comments? I guess not any comment on the record that they wanted to give you.
No, not really. I've been trying to get something, but it just seems like there's a lot of fear right now.
Senator Romney released a statement, specifically about the death of this Utah man, I think.
Yeah, he did. He said obviously his heart goes out to, the man's family and things like that, and kind of unequivocally stated that, he stands with Israel and the Jewish people and Utah's Jewish community as well.
And in your story, the U.S. State Department, at least at that point, confirmed 22 Americans have been killed in the war, at least that as of Wednesday.
Yeah, and I haven't actually looked that up since then, but yeah, at that point it was 22.
Yeah, very, very, very sad. I'm sure that you and Jordan, the other reporters, will be keeping us up to date on this Utah connections to this war in Israel.
Yeah,
Anything
definitely.
else you'd like to say about this?
No, not really. I haven't been as involved probably as Jordan has. I've just been kind of doing mop-up duties as you do on these sort of things at the end of the day, so.
Yeah. Let's turn Peyton Harkins to this story. An interesting kind of kerfuffle happened. The headline is Utah is not a sanctuary state, Governor Cox says, citing outdated ICE memo shared with state leaders. Tell me first of all about this memo.
So this memo So there's two memos, and the first one apparently came out in May, but I did not hear about it until the end of last week. And it kind of came to me in a roundabout way. It was, you know, first came this press release from Riverton Mayor Trent Staggs, who was responding to the memo, you know, saying that essentially he did not appreciate that Utah was called a sanctuary state and he would like, you know, political leaders to step up to change that. And then, you know, I kind of wondered what that was about, but I didn't do much about it. And then Governor Cox and Stuart Adams and Brad Wilson all sent out a combined press release later that day, also responding to this memo, you know, and saying that they had met with ICE about it and they were going to retract the memo and all this stuff. And so I finally got somebody to talk to me about what this memo was. And it came out in May. It was basically the director of the ICE field office here had just sent a memo that designated Utah as a quote sanctuary state. And it was because Utah currently has no jails that contract with ICE to hold their detainees. And so basically, you know, these would be people who, you know, are scheduled to be deported or have some kind of hearing related to that. And so a lot of times, you know, they'll contract with local jails to kind of hold these people, you know, say they'd been arrested for, I don't know, some kind of misdemeanor or something, and they were in jail. This gives the jail authority to hold them past, you know, the charges that they'd have for whatever misdemeanor they were arrested on or something, so that they can get into ICE custody and then start that sort of hearing process with ICE. And so, yeah, no Utah jails currently have a contract with them. Some Utah jails did, but they stopped, you know, let those contracts lapse. And, you know, the sheriff's associations who run Utah jails seem to think that this designation was to put some kind of political pressure on Utah's sheriffs to sign these agreements so that Utah would not be designated a sanctuary state.
Yeah, sanctuary state, I guess on one side, that would be a compliment. On the other side, this is a slur, right?
Certainly in Utah, they took it that way, it seems like.
So who wrote that memo? And what, I guess, is he saying why he accused Utah of being a sanctuary state?
So the memo was written by, it's the director of the Salt Lake City ICE field office named Michael Bernacki. And all I really know about that memo is its title, which was Sanctuary State Designation for the State of Utah. And in the second memo that I actually did see, it described it as saying that it was about the detention capacity difficulties with the state of Utah, and specifically Cache, Utah, and Washington County Sheriff's Office. Those were kind of the three jails that had one time had contracts with ICE. And yeah, that's basically what I know about that first memo. But apparently it got passed along to some political leaders in Utah, including, for whatever reason, this Riverton mayor. He seems to be the only mayor that I know of that received this memo. And the rest kind of seem to be, you know, state lawmakers and stuff like that.
So his name is Staggs?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mr. Staggs, he seemed to be quite put out that Utah had received this designation.
Yeah, he was. And it was interesting because, you know, he was upset about this sanctuary state designation, just like, you know, the other Utah folks that I quoted in the article. But he kind of put it on, you know, he thought that, you know, Utah state leaders maybe should sign these contracts and stop the sanctuary state designation. But the Utah Sheriff's Association, when they responded to this, also took issue with Stagg's statement, even though they were ostensibly on the same side, you know, saying that his opinion was naive and uninformed, and it was in support of, quote, ICE's liberal agenda that blames state leaders for ICE's failures. And so Utah's whole point is that, you know, whatever problems that ICE is having with the number of detainees they need housed or whatever, that's a federal government issue, and Utah's has no obligation to help them fix that, especially since they say that these contracts with ICE are not necessarily good deals for the jails that take them up. You know, they pay a lesser rate per day for their detainees to stay in jail than the jail normally gets to keep, you know, the inmates they keep. And, you know, they were just saying that these contracts make it to where effectively jails have like two sets of rules that they use, you know, one for the, you know, for the local state inmates, and then another set of rules for the federal detainees. And so Utah sheriffs are kind of like, you know, we don't have to help you with this if it's not a good deal.
So two sets of rules, which would be, you know, unwieldy. I think there's sheriffs are saying that if, you know, if we kind of have these two sets of rules, we leave ourselves open to lawsuits and pressure from pressure groups, right?
Yeah. It's because I was talking to Mike Smith, who's the Utah County Sheriff, but also he's the president of the Utah Sheriff's Association. And he was saying that, you know, the two sets of rules include things like separate entry, like, you know, sally ports, if you're familiar with jail parlance, for, you know, for ICE detainees versus their inmates. And he said that's unfeasible. And, you know, there's a whole other disciplinary kind of system that they go through for ICE detainees than what they use for inmates. You know, like say if somebody's caught with contraband, you know, or, you know, whatever, you get in trouble with jail, there's a different sort of disciplinary system for these people. And so, yeah, he was saying that, you know, if the jail doesn't follow these terms, which they say are unfeasible, then yes, it opens them up to, you know, scrutiny from these different groups and lawsuits and things like that. And he, you know, that's another reason that he says this deal is bad.
I think the Sheriff's Association is also saying, you mentioned this, the money doesn't work. ICE doesn't pay enough.
Yeah, it's the difference in the daily rates to house federal detainees versus to house just like a regular inmate. You know, the federal government pays less. And so, yeah, it doesn't work out from a cost standpoint either.
Hmm. So the governor and the other leaders, they took umbrage to this statement, and that it was, I guess, you know, part of it was a pretty scathing statement back. Tell me about that.
Yeah. No, it definitely seemed like they took issue with being called a sanctuary state. And I mean, they even said in their, you know, their memo that they don't have a problem with, you know, I wish I had the statement pulled up in front of me because I don't want to misspeak. But, you know, it's like they are okay with immigration in a certain way, you know, but they just did not like being called a sanctuary state. And, you know, they apparently culminated in some kind of meeting between these state leaders and the ICE field office, where the ICE director that wrote this memo ended up rescinding the memo, saying that it was outdated, and you know, tried to reiterate that, you know, they are working with Utahns to try to, you know, have a good relationship and increase public safety and border security and all that.
There's one passage in the story that it's puzzling to me, probably to you as well, if you didn't get you know, more a statement from Mr. Bernanke, the ICE field office head. In his subsequent statement, withdrawing the sanctuary state designation, he says his original designation was notional in nature. Did he say anything about that?
No, I never actually got to speak with him. I reached out quite a bit on Friday, and I apparently had some bad info about how to get in contact with the ICE field office, but they ended up sending me an updated statement. And it just kind of said the same thing that was in that menu or in that memo that I obtained, though, you know, just this idea that it said again that the memo was notional, and that, you know, they want to maintain open collaborative efforts working with Utah and stuff like that. But no, I did not get a chance to sort of further dig into what that means, what the notional in nature means.
So state leaders apparently met with Mr. Bernanke, did they? What was
yeah,
the outcome?
They ended up rescinding that memo. I don't know what went on. I kind of get the feeling that it might have been a virtual meeting. I'm not sure if it was in person or online. But yeah, ended up saying he was going to rescind the memo and, you know, trying to sort of patch things up. And then, yeah, later that day, the memo came out and rescinded it, said it was outdated, and seemed to, you know, be trying to patch that relationship up.
In the meantime, the state leaders were very clear. They're saying this is a federal problem. Any blame should go to the feds.
Yeah, that is what they're saying. And, you know, they're saying that, like, as, you know, more people come across the border into the U.S., obviously there's going to be more detainees in Utah, and it's not really their fault that that is happening. And so unless there's, you know, a good deal for them to take to work with ICE, similar, you know, they brought up the U.S. Marshals Service. They have a good relationship with them to sort of hold folks in jails for them. And so they were hoping to, you know, release or reach some kind of agreement with ICE that was just as, you know, that worked just as well as that agreement. But at this point, you know, the current deals being offered are not there, according to, you know, the Utah sheriffs.
Finally, at the end of your story, you have a quote from the head of the Sheriff's Association. Seems like the ICE has some work to do with with the sheriffs.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like what Mike Smith was saying, that they kind of don't see a way forward working with Bernanke in particular. And, you know, maybe it can be fixed or something, but that statement was pretty strong with me, which is, you know, why I included it in the story. But, it, you know, it seems to be almost calling to work with somebody else if you read between the lines. But, you know, there's that.
Well, very interesting story. Peyton Harkins, thanks for telling us about this.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for asking.
We're going to take a break, and you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. When we come back, we'll be talking with the renewable energy reporter Tim Fitzpatrick. The headline, Northern Utah's ozone problem isn't getting any better. More following this break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams. And now we turn to renewable energy reporter Tim Fitzpatrick. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So the story, Northern Utah's ozone problem is not getting better. And specifically, the Environmental Protection Agency looks likely, according to your story, to move Utah to a different category. Tell me about these categories. Where does Utah sit now, and where is it likely to move?
Well, Tom, basically, we usually make progress over the years in air quality, but with ozone in northern Utah, we plateaued and maybe even slipped a little. A few years ago, we were at the moderate, or actually, we were at the marginal non-attainment level in EPA language. That dropped down to moderate, and now we're going to go to serious, and it's even possible we could get to severe. It's basically 85% of the ozone in northern Utah doesn't come from human sources in Utah. It either drifts in from out of state or even out of country, or it comes from natural sources within the state. So we have kind of a limited number of levers we can pull to deal with this. But it's still basically, you could make a pretty good case that we haven't been aggressive enough in attacking that 15% we can control.
Let me pull back and have you to define ozone for us. We hear this all the time. What is ozone?
Ozone is three oxygen molecules in a row. It's O3. If you have O2, you've got oxygen. It's a good thing. It's what we breathe. But when you get an O3 molecule down at ground level, it is seriously lung irritant. People with asthma have issues. It basically cuts lives, and that's why EPA regulates it. That's why it's a dangerous pollutant. When it's up in the upper atmosphere, it's actually blocking UV rays and keeping us safe. But down at ground level, it's a bad thing.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. Because up in the upper atmosphere, we want it, but I guess we want it there and not down at ground level. At ground level, I guess it causes these health problems that you just mentioned.
Yeah, and it's a summer problem. Basically, you have a couple of pollutants, NOx and volatile organic compounds, When you combine those with sunlight, you can produce ozone at ground level. What we're finding basically is that the summers are getting longer and they're getting hotter. So what used to be an ozone season that was really just July and August is now almost April to October. And that's made it a lot harder to try to stay under the level.
So I'm reading from your story. The EPA has set a safe limit at 70 parts per billion. Where is Northern Utah?
Well, it's a complicated formula that basically they allow three violations per year, and then they look at the fourth highest total in each year. And it can be across multiple, we have multiple stations in Utah that are checking for ozone. And if any one of them on that fourth highest is over 70, then we're in violation. We've been averaging, I guess, about 77 is our highest. So we're still, you know, a decent amount of distance away from it. And that's why we continue to just go from moderate to serious to wherever.
So I guess the problem with ozone is, I guess locally, we're producing only a certain percentage of this, right? The ozone's drifting in from outside the state, is it?
The Utah Department Division of Air Quality tried to make the case once before. The EPA allows what they call 179B exemption, which is basically they let if you can prove that your ozone is coming from a foreign source, they'll let you off the hook. We tried that and we couldn't prove it, basically. And the reason we couldn't prove it is because we couldn't show that the foreign sources were going up on the days that we were violating and not on the days that we weren't violating. So they didn't, you know, it's a hard case to make. I think that El Paso, Texas has made it before because they had pollution drifting in from Mexico next door. But we're a long ways from foreign sources. So it was just a harder case to make. It really, you know, basically it's on us to try to figure out our 15%. And there are levers we can pull. Most of it is, most of what gets regulated right now is the big, like dozen or so big producers, like oil refineries, that sort of a thing. But we don't do much on trying to regulate old cars or regulate dirty cars. I think that's an opportunity that we could do more with. In Utah, we tend to not do anything beyond what the feds require us to do with regard to air quality. I think the Utah legislature tends to view anything beyond what the feds require as something that's going to hurt the economy. And you can, of course, argue that bad air hurts the economy, too. But they're trying to figure that out.
So what are advocates talking about? Regulate more, plants, more industry, and then certainly the cars?
Yeah. The plants can have an argument to say this is not reasonably affordable, and so I can't do it. And so they do what they consider to be reasonably affordable and what the state considers to be reasonably affordable. They in this last round, they required Marathon Oil to add a little bit more equipment. And they also made a requirement some of U.S. Magnesium, which is the big, evaporation ponds out in the lake. But they didn't really require anything of anybody else. I think really the missing opportunity here is cars. We don't do anything to discourage dirty cars. Part of it is we really need to incentivize clean cars because the people who drive dirty cars, the old dirty cars, tend to be people who don't have a lot of money. And you don't want to put the burden on them. But those old dirty cars are causing an outsized part of this problem. If you want to look down the road 10 years, we might be in better shape as cars electrify. And that'll do two things. One, it will clean up the cars, but it'll also probably close a couple of oil refineries. We have five oil refineries in northern Utah that are all cranking out stuff that's causing problems. And if people don't need as much gas, then we might not need as many refineries.
So I think I understand the wintertime particulates a little better here. What, but with the ozone, what causes ozone?
Yeah, again, it's those what they call precursor chemicals, nitrous oxides and volatile organic compounds interacting with sunlight. And so sun is a very important part of it. You need a certain amount of heat. You got to have warm days, and you got to have lots of sunlight. Mm. And so particulates, where we've made a little bit better progress on, that's the wintertime. That's the wintertime, you know, inversion problem. That's not ozone, that's particulates. And we're making a little bit better progress, though, although, you know, we're up against federal levels there, too.
I want to follow up this. You talked a little bit about this, but have you expand on this? One of your experts in the story, and this, I think, was in pursuit of trying to get a 179B exception. This person said background levels of ozone average about 50 parts per billion in Western states. Eastern states, background ozone hovers around 20 to 25 parts per billion. Why higher in the West?
Altitude.
Ah.
It's basically we're higher, I guess I don't know all the chemistry behind that, but basically they blame altitude. The West has more cities at higher elevations.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing, I don't know if they put this in their formal 179B application, but, you know, I'm guessing Western states view this as unfair. We're higher, more prone to ozone, I suppose. And I don't know, maybe they want regulations to be different because of that.
Yeah, you know, nobody is really asking for that. I mean, it is, fairness, I'm not sure is the word, but it is a different situation. But the reality is we all have the same set of human lungs. And if we're frying them, we got to do something about it. If that's our situation and it's not someone else's situation, it's still our situation and we have to address it.
So you mentioned in the story, that we have made some progress on wintertime, you know, pollution, but not on ozone. Why do we think that is?
Well, again, I think it goes back to the fact that the summers have gotten longer and hotter. I guess I don't really know this for sure, but my impression is that the ozone problem is growing worldwide because of global warming. So it's becoming a harder situation. You know, some of this is the natural ozone that's produced is also growing because of longer summer. So we need to get ahead of it. I mean, I think if you look at electrifying cars is probably the best long-term solution we've got.
Just another question or two here. My curiosity, I didn't quite understand this. We talked about vehicles, right? We talked about big industrial plants. But one of these people you quoted in the article said that we need to look better at buildings. Do buildings produce ozone?
Yes. And that's basically from heating them. And it's most of it is natural gas, basically. Natural gas does produce pollutants when it's burned. So that contributes. There are lots of things we could do to make buildings more efficient. And we're doing a lot of them. And there's a trade-off. You know, the Home Builders Association of Utah pushes back pretty hard on trying to make the envelopes of buildings of houses more tight so that they're more fuel efficient. The reason they push back basically is because we're already in a situation where people can't afford housing. They're trying to build housing and they're trying to build it as economically as possible. But at the same time, houses have a 50-year life and we have to try to make them as efficient as possible because they're going to be around for a long time. So there's a push back and forth on that. It's hard to say, you know, that housing is not a huge contributor. But again, when we're in this situation where we got to find whatever we can find, that's probably an area where we need to look at too.
Finally on this, Tim, if, as kind of expected, in a couple of years, Utah is moved to Sirius, I guess regulations ramp up. What's the consequence?
Yeah, you could see a little bit more regulation around cars. But the big thing is that we go from about 12 major industries that get regulated, major companies that get regulated, to about 60. We go, anything that produces more than 100 tons of pollutants has to be regulated under the moderate status. Anything that produces over 50 tons, that could pick up, you know, like some bakeries. That was one of the ones they mentioned, that I guess bakeries put out a fair amount of pollutants. So, you know, big baking companies, they'll fall into regulation now.
A very interesting story. Ozone in northern Utah. Tim Fitzpatrick, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
We're going to go to break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. When we come back, we'll be talking with real estate reporter Tony Semerad. There's a big survey and some meetings, interactive meetings, and we're going to learn what Utahns think about how the state should grow following this break.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune real estate reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Tom.
So very interesting story. This is a survey and a whole, I guess, process called Guiding Our Growth. Tell us what this is.
Well, Tom, the state has had polling going back for 20 years that only recently in the last 3 or 4 years has shown that Utahns have essentially turned negative about the idea of growth. The feeling is that the pressures of growth, the negative pressures of growth, kind of outweigh the positive ones, at least by some margin in this polling. It's a first in the state, and it's for some state officials kind of an alarming trend, state and government officials. This Guiding Our Growth poll went out, started being available to Utahns in May. It's a state-backed poll, and essentially is trying to gauge sentiment with regard to growth strategies on a number of key issues. Quite comprehensive as these things go, very extensive outreach to all 29 counties, lots of in-person workshops, and then these sort of interactive interfaces that have reached upwards of, you know, 20,000 people. It segmented. It's been an interesting poll in terms of segmentation between urban and rural interests. That's kind of a first in terms of granularity at getting at these issues. And what it's done is provided kind of a blueprint for state lawmakers with regard to the key issues of housing, water, transportation, and open space. And you know, some of the individual findings on sentiments are really quite fascinating.
Well, yeah, let's take each of these areas in turn. I guess as a background in your story, you point out that the Utah's projected population in 2050 is 5 million. So that'd be 2 million more people, you know, almost doubling the state currently at 3 million. So what did people have to say about housing?
Well, so the fascinating thing there is that just how much sentiment has shifted from the old days of suburban kind of sprawl single family home development. Utahns in very strong percentages want a variety of housing products. They're welcome, you know, they welcome housing in new undeveloped areas, greenfield development to some extent. But there's very much an emphasis on placing housing near community centers, near transit nodes, and in existing neighborhoods. Something like 60% of urban residents favor this. They want smaller lots. They want townhomes and duplexes, more accessory dwellings. Lots of kind of a push towards additional housing options, and you can very clearly see that the housing crisis is reflecting in these numbers. Rural Utahns don't feel too differently. Their housing growth, preferred housing growth pattern tends to be more around creating kind of lively town centers and a focus on maintaining county roads, but then focusing kind of development in the along the main street. And might surprise you, rural Utahns by about a two-thirds margin disagree with the old strategy of building new houses on large spread out lots that, you know, contribute to a lot of land consumption and resource use.
Yeah, that is surprising. Water, what's the top takeaway from water?
Well, you know, clearly the drought and the plight of the Great Salt Lake are playing heavily in these numbers. Utahns, urban and rural, want aggressive water conservation efforts. They're encouraging the state to provide a lot more investment to encourage residents to, do water-wise landscaping, more compact development, conversion of existing spaces. And this press for resources to optimize agricultural irrigation is a very popular idea in rural areas. Something like 70% of rural Utahns support rebates and incentives, not only for landscape conversions, but for optimizing agriculture. And there is a very clear drive and sort of coherence in the numbers towards aggressive water conservation.
Another area that this survey checked in on was transportation. What's the top takeaway there?
Well, yeah, again, the old car-centric days of sprawl development are in the past. Utahns want additional public transit. They want trails. They want bicycles, bike paths, in addition to car infrastructure for getting around. Something like 70% of urban Utahns want to focus development in town centers, along with convenient kind of walkability and transit options. There's heavy support for additional funding for public transportation in urban and rural areas. We've clearly got a long way to go in terms of bus service and that sort of thing, and rail service to the rural areas. But clear majorities support that in rural areas. And again, in the rural areas, there's this interesting idea of, you know, where you invest, and they'd like high use state highways maintained, but there's a big focus on Main Street in rural Utah as well.
Yeah, interesting. It is interesting, this kind of rural urban divide as we go along, and in some cases, a few cases, the two agree, and mostly disagree. What about open space? What are people saying?
Well, you know, what's notable to somebody like me that has covered this issue for a long time is the strong presence that open space has at the table, if you will, in terms of this discussion. That's a very, very notable feature here, that it's just as much of a topic of debate in growth strategies as housing and transportation. Utahns want open spaces preserved within their communities, but also on the edge of communities. There's a great deal of interest in, master plan communities, and Daybreak is a good example of that in South Jordan, where parks and trails and community open spaces have been incorporated and are sort of more interdispersed within the development. Something like 75% of Utahns are calling for heavy investments in recreational amenities. These are the trailheads and the campgrounds and the recreation facilities that some people feel are getting a little bit more crowded as population grows. And there are very similar patterns in rural Utah, with this very interesting additional wrinkle of support for prioritizing the preservation of prime farmlands and incorporating those in the planning efforts.
And reading from your story, only 6% of urban dwellers favored construction of more new neighborhoods with large yards. They want more compact, sounds like.
Yeah, that seems really to be, like I say, thinking with regard to some of these growth principles has really shifted. We had a similar focus like this in the late 90s when Utah was growing very rapidly, and the ideas that were disseminated disseminated have been shown to have saved resources. We've preserved a tremendous amount of green space and water by applying these smart growth principles up until now. And so, yeah, there very much seems to be an awareness that we can't develop the same way we have.
Just one more thing on this, Tony. This really stood out to me. This is back on water. According from the story, only 20% of city dwellers, 29% of rural residents, so, you know, the smaller minorities, felt that pinching off housing development was a viable strategy for reducing future water demand. They didn't see this as a way that we should be reducing water demand.
Yeah, and it's super interesting to see the interrelated threads here, right? Because in most of the scenarios where Utahns were asked, you know, about slow or no growth strategies, a lot of times their comments and their conclusions pointed to that making housing more expensive. The concern was, okay, if you're squeezing off development, you're limiting it in some ways, that's going to drive prices up. And so this has gotten at a more nuanced and balanced thinking than a lot of Utahns are doing when it comes to growth.
So Tony, among other audiences, or maybe this is the sole audience that's directed at the legislature, is it?
Well, this is literally a roadmap that will be handed to the state legislature, and it already is sort of a convergence with the January legislative session. This is very much intended as a blueprint for how lawmakers addressed things like investments in recreation and water infrastructure and how they tweak housing policy. This is meant to guide that, called guiding our growth. Not only at the legislative level, but it will be incorporated in a lot of planning documents. The people behind this very much want Utahns to know there is a plan. And that, you know, the decisions we do make right now are going to have big implications 10 and 20 years from now.
Very interesting story. Real estate reporter Tony Semerad has been with us to talk about this. Thanks, Tony.
You bet.
Well, let's now go to our underplayed stories of the week, and we'll start with Jordan Miller. Jordan, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Hey, yeah, I really thought the story on the oil spill in Grand Staircase Escalante was interesting. It was by Anastasia Huffam, and it kind of detailed this oil spill that occurred last month and a couple of other, specifically one more oil spill that happened in the area previously.
All right. You can find that at sltrib.com. Thank you. Peyton Harkins, what's your underplayed story of the week?
I'm going to shamelessly self-promote myself and a story that I wrote. It's a story that I wrote about this rare fossil find along the shores of Lake Powell. It's like this early mammal relative called a tritylodont, and that's interesting all in itself for a host of reasons I get into this story. But this is where they found these fossils, is a place that was just previously submerged with water. And since Lake Powell's been having so many issues with water, you know, as has the whole Colorado Basin, you know, more shoreline was available to search for bones than they found them. And so I think they're going to be able to go back in years to come and find even more rare bones that they hadn't had access to. So check that out.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. SLTrib.com for that one as well. Tim Fitzpatrick, what's your underplayed story of the week?
I went with Carmen Nesbitt's story about gun detection software in schools. Apparently, we are going to enter into a multi-million-dollar contract with a vendor that's going to use artificial intelligence to crawl through security camera footage in real time, looking for odd bulges in students' clothing and things like that. When the software flags something, there will be people sitting in a control room somewhere reviewing the footage and notifying the school if they think it's a real threat. I'm a little dubious about how well that will work, but we'll see.
Yeah, you can find that at sltrib.com as well. That was a pretty interesting story as well. Tony Semerad, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Well, it might be low-hanging fruit, but I am picking the solar eclipse.
Uh-huh.
There will be an eclipse visible through portions of Utah, total eclipse kind of visible in the Torrey and Richfield and Lake Powell area, and then a partial if you're up on the Wasatch Front. It's coming your way tomorrow, and we've got lots of good stuff on sltrib.com on how to watch it, and we got the bluff mayor telling people not to come because it's going to be
yeah. Yeah, that's right. I enjoyed that story, all those stories. Yeah, so get your eclipse glasses, and even if you're not in the path of totality, you can enjoy that. Yeah, you can find those stories at sltrib.com. I think for my underplayed story, I'm going to reach back a week or two for another story of Peyton's. I never got a chance to talk to Peyton about this, so this is about Tooele County. Very interesting. The headline is Utah's fastest growing county empties out most mornings. Leaders are trying to change that. So talking about water, traffic, loss of a small town feel. Interesting issues of growth there in Tooele County. Check that story out at sltrib.com. Well, we've been joined today by reporter Jordan Miller, reporter Peyton Harkins, renewable energy reporter Tim Fitzpatrick, real estate reporter Tony Semerad, and we've been talking about all the latest stories, including the underplayed stories of the week, on Behind the Headlines, which is the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. Hope you join us next week. Thanks for listening.